You've dropped into Juicebox Radio, where sexuality educators quench your search for responsible, progressive sexuality over your lifespan.
You've landed in Juicebox Radio on CITR 101.9, or you could download every show if you want to at juiceboxradio.com. And it will be taking calls tonight, so feel free to contribute and add to the conversation we're going to be having at 604-822-2487. That's 604-UBC-CITR. All the papers are moving around
here. Yeah, just trying to get organized here.
They're kind of dancing all over.
You know what's so great is Caroline's behind the driver's seat tonight, which I'm always happy to have happening. And I'm close to the phone, so if you want to call in, Julia is going to try her best to answer the phone properly. So we'll probably give the number out again because we have a fabulous guest, and I think that our listeners are going to want to pick his brain. We have one of the most fabulous doctors in the city. Yes, Dr. Hugh Jones joining us in the box tonight. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
It's so great. I'm actually pretty stoked because this is Malika Millions' fabulous doctor that she'd spoken about on the Fuck Uterus, Happy Birthday, whatever it was show. When Malika was pre-operative for her hysterectomy, and she's now post-operative, and I'm sure, as we spoke about her a couple weeks ago, she's doing very well, and I think she's actually out and about this weekend doing an event on the 30th of November. She's going to be performing, so she's obviously doing well. It's at the Wise Hall, right? Something like that?
I think so.
Yeah. We did it on Juiceberries last week, so forgive me for not having the details in front of me. So she's recovered. She's doing well. And you know what? Thanks to Dr. Jones, who was in the house tonight, she was diagnosed properly and was sent down the road to recovery. So,
and she's doing quite well.
And she's doing very well.
Oh, my goodness.
I feel like I can't hear myself. Anyway, so we have our doctor, our good doctor in the house, and so do call in to 822-2487 UBC-CITR and ask him questions. So what are we talking about tonight, Caroline?
Well, we're going to be talking about the good, the bad, and the scary in the world of STIs and just how to alleviate all those fears that surround all the STIs. Because, Dr. Jones, you work in one of the busiest clinics in Vancouver.
Right, right. You know, we're down on West 12th between
BC.
BGH and City Hall.
Right, and it's the BC Centre for Disease Control.
Right.
Which leads us to our first question. With this STD, STI conversation, people are constantly asking me as a sex educator, why do they change it to STI? So I thought I would let you explain that to the listeners tonight. What is the difference between STD and STI? Why did they change it?
Sure. And it, our name even was something different. I've been around since the late 1970s, actually pre-HIV, and at that time we were called venereal disease control. And it was
there was no penises because... with any diseases, I guess, just the vulvas. Okay.
That's right. And Venus was the goddess of love, I think, and so that's how
it got. Oh, is that what venereal was? I thought it just meant vagina.
Yeah, no, Venus, the goddess of love, and...
All the Vs.
There were five classical venereal diseases called the venereal quintet, actually.
Venereal quintet. Which ones were they, the four?
Gonorrhea,
the four ghosts?
Syphilis, chancroid, granuloma inguinale, and lymphogranuloma venereum.
Whoa.
So the gonorrhea and syphilis are the ones that are still around. The other ones are sort of rare.
Have they been completely taken out of North America, or are they just in...
Their chancroid's kind of a tropical thing. Causes a sore on the genitals.
Shingles?
Different. That's kind of a different type of herpes. A herpes zoster instead of herpes simplex.
That's right. Actually, I have a question for you on that. Yeah. We're going to get into something else.
Sure.
But just quickly, what popped into my mind about this herpes and the shingles thing. If you have genital herpes or oral herpes, will you be more likely to get shingles? Are they related in that way at all?
No, not at all. Shingles is related
to
chickenpox.
Shingles and chickenpox.
It's the chickenpox virus. So if you've ever had chickenpox, you can get shingles. But lots of people have it asymptomatically, much like a lot of the things that we're talking about.
Yes, the STIs we're going to get to. So this is STD, STI. So really, STD stands for disease, and STI is infection.
Yeah, and as our tests get better and our understanding of the infections gets better, we realize that disease kind of implies symptoms. And actually, the majority of people that we see, we don't necessarily see them, but the majority of people that have these different STIs actually don't have symptoms. And so we've changed the name, went from venereal disease control to sexually transmitted disease control, and now we're sexually transmitted infection HIV control.
I've got the papers rattling. And banging on the counter. I'm being so bad. I'm sorry. Caroline's making faces at me. I'm being terrible. You know, okay, so I think what's interesting, yes, okay. Caroline and I decided tonight that we were going to start doing some hand gestures at each other because we cut each other off too much. And I ask her questions and she's like, I'm fine. I don't have anything to add. Please don't ask me to do that anymore. So we had a little conversation. So we're going to try doing some hand gestures. So, you know, just bear with us as we work at getting to be better and better every day. We're better and better in so many ways. Okay, I'm trying to figure out where I'm going with this. Could you help me out, please?
Okay, I wasn't sure why you were looking at me in that regard.
Thanks. Julia, I need some roping in.
I do have a question in regards to it. When you switched from venereal disease to STIs and things like that, how did you find more people were more comfortable coming to the clinic? Because I know just the words disease control actually just scare me, just the words, if I was concerned that I'd have something. And then you just mentioned that a lot of the STIs, there's not necessarily symptoms.
Right.
So why wouldn't they go to the regular doctor?
I'm not so sure changing the terminology helped, but we took down the sign that said sexually transmitted infection clinic and just put clinic on the outside of the building, and that made people a lot more comfortable.
I can imagine. That would make me more comfortable myself.
I wouldn't want to walk into any place that said sexually transmitted infection. Yes, I'm coming in. You're like, you walk in with like glasses and a hat on your head and a big coat.
And it's right on 12, too. So
yeah,
no,
everyone's seeing you.
And now I've forgotten what your question was.
Oh, I just think...
Yeah, just clarifying if there's more people who are coming because and why they'd go to the clinic. But I think you clarified that in terms of saying it doesn't say STD clinic out in front anymore. It just says clinic. So people are more inclined probably to go because it's not broadcasting, hey, I think there might be something wrong with me, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I don't think we see a lot more people because of that. I think people are more
aware?
Comfortable. But one of the reasons that we see people, like some people don't have family doctors. I think a lot of people have medical insurance now, but some people don't have that too. But the one thing that you can do when you come to our clinic is you don't have to use your real identity. Whereas if you go to a walk-in clinic, then they would want your care card, and of course you have to use your real identity. So some people prefer to use a phony name, and that's one of the advantages coming to us. And it may be that the family doctor knows them or is the family doctor, and so they're worried about their confidentiality that way. So that's one of the big advantages we have.
That's
and
a good one.
If somebody's named as a contact to something and we call them, then sometimes they're more comfortable coming here because they might not want their doctor to know that they've been a contact to something.
Yeah.
So they're, despite everything, there's a lot of stigma still associated with sexually transmitted infections.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. It just, we thought it would settle with time. I think it is somewhat better, but it still seems to persist.
Well, what are some of the more common STIs that you see?
Yeah, let's get to the four horsemen here.
Sure, okay.
We were talking syphilis, herpes, gonorrhea, chlamydia. There's those ones other than herpes. I'd say syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia are pretty asymptomatic as far as the big problem why people keep exchanging them to each other because they don't actually know they have them. Is that not?
Yeah, they can be. Actually, it was estimated with syphilis that in the early 1900s, one in four people in North America had syphilis.
This is so crazy. 25%?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But most people wouldn't have symptoms with it. But at the same time, a lot of the neonatal mortality was quite high for a lot of different reasons. But half of babies that died then died because of syphilis.
Wow. Really?
So,
I had no idea.
Exactly.
Huh.
So lots of people caught it. And lots of people didn't get much in the way of symptoms, but some people can get really bad things with it. With herpes, one study that Dr. Sachs, who's died now, but he was our herpes expert for many years, did a study at Grace Hospital, which is now Women's Hospital, just taking women that came in to have babies, and they had the blood test for type 2 herpes.
Mm-hmm.
What they found is the more partners they had in their lifetime, the more likely they were to have antibodies to type 2. And back then, 10 partners in a lifetime wasn't a hard number to get to. And women that had 10 partners, 67%, I think, had antibodies to type 2. And of those, only a third had symptoms. Now, if you take people that know that they have antibodies to type 2 and really interview them carefully, you can get it higher, maybe about a half or a little bit more. But still, half of people have no symptoms at all. And that's how these things can be effectively transmitted.
Yeah, well, we'll talk a little bit more about herpes later, but I just want to get to, I want to sort of see what you think the cases are around syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia in Vancouver specifically, or in your clinic in Vancouver, what you're seeing there. Is it as a habit, or I mean as a pattern?
You mean statistics-wise?
Mm-hmm. Statistics, or? And then let's talk a little bit about some of the symptoms and kind of how people can get it. And that's usually what the learners want to know that I teach to. That's what they tend to want to know that information.
Sure. Kind of statistics in probably the province is better than our clinic. Our clinic is...
Okay, yeah, provinces, sure.
Mm-hmm. Statistics, syphilis, there are probably about 300 new cases of syphilis a year.
That's crazy.
In the province.
Yeah, I thought it had been eradicated.
Yeah, it had really dropped down in the summer of 97. There were just 18 cases a year, and then it started taking off.
It increased. I remember the street nurses in the downtown east side were actually interviewing some of the sex workers. Can't remember if it was 2001 or 2002.
Right.
Just because they'd noticed a huge increase at that time.
And they actually had a blitz at that time where they tried treating the sex workers and giving them treatment for their partners with a drug called azithromycin, and it dropped it a little bit for a while, but then it rebounded.
Why do you think that is after all this time?
Probably, or why did it rebound? I think we just didn't get everybody, and when you treat somebody for syphilis, gonorrhea, or chlamydia, you cure them, but you make them susceptible again. So we just didn't get everybody, but we made everybody susceptible at the same time. And
why?
Then,
susceptible? Why?
Well, just once they're treated, they can catch it again.
Okay. Oh, I see.
So then there was this whole vulnerable populace. When you sort of have it, not quite like you're immune, but and with some things, like with syphilis, the infectivity drops with time, too.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's the three levels of syphilis, too. There's the initial infection, then there's the rash, the body rash,
right,
which is the secondary, then there's the tertiary, which is when it starts to really eat away at your brain and do horrible things to your body and things like that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, so syphilis is still seems like it's kind of not as common as, say, chlamydia, which is basically the high. Is that not the
right,
the
yeah.
most common one now?
Yeah, and there are chlamydia. About 10,000 cases a year in the province of chlamydia.
Crazy? That's
yeah.
crazy.
And chlamydia is the silent kind of, not killer, but the one that makes you sterile. Like
yeah,
chlamydia
exactly.
sterilizes, so
yeah.
it's really a nasty, nasty little bugger. And so women, what's the percentage of women that show any symptoms or that don't show symptoms? Do you have those statistics as well?
I don't know if I know the percentage for that, but
I think it's 80% of women and 70% of men have no symptoms of chlamydia.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons why I think it is 10,000 cases mm-hmm. in BC, because people don't have a clue. They have no clue at all. I actually know two women have become sterile on chlamydia.
Right.
They had it for 10 years, had no idea. I mean, they're married. They, you know, their husband, whatever, has an affair.
Were they women?
Brings home a nice little bug. She gets it, has no clue, because she's not having sex with anyone but him and doesn't even think to get tested for STIs.
Yeah.
Would that be, but don't you automatically get tested when you get your pap every year? Wouldn't that come up as abnormal when in...
Nowadays, maybe you do, but...
It can happen. The risk factors, one is age under 25, more than two partners in the last 2 months. But it may be that not all docs ask their patients that. If mm-hmm. they think patients in a monogamous relationship, they might not think it's appropriate to ask that.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's another advantage of our clinic. Sometimes people can come in to us, and
mm-hmm.
We ask all sorts of rude questions, and it's expected... We're nice about it, but we do ask a number of
what
partners.
What sort of rude questions do you have?
What do you mean?
You've intrigued us.
Yeah, different types of contacts you have, like oral sex, rectal sex, the regular stuff, and well, that's not the right term. That's a bit judgmental, you know.
The vaginal, penile. You can
yeah.
say all
you
these
can
words.
Say all this.
You can
yeah.
say all these words. It's fine.
Yeah, and in our clinic, we probably use the insertive rectal sex, receptive, things like that. But on with street nurses, they probably use more blowjobs and mm-hmm. slang terms that kind of fit more with
right.
that populace.
Right.
So we ask those. Numbers of sex partners in the last few months.
Oh, yeah. No, I've never had that question posed to me by any doctor.
I have.
I'd be like, it's none of your business.
Exactly.
I think it is their business, though, because how can they treat us if they don't know what's going on? I think it's important to have all the information.
I guess, but I don't think it matters. I think what matters is that you say you've had an unprotected sexual encounter or that you've had some kind of exposure to some risk and that you're concerned and whatever. It could be one person. It could be one time. It could be anal. It could be oral. It doesn't matter. I think very personal question to be asking. I've had 16 in the last hour, doctor. Yes, I'm
yes.
an info and I make a lot of money. Like, I don't know. Like,
I think it's important, whatever. Though, because what if you do have an STI and you need to contact all those people?
Yeah,
really
that's
true. Thinking about that and thinking about those people's
yeah.
histories. I remember when we were in elementary school. Do you remember when the sex educators used to come to the school and they'd show that diagram? It's like, okay, well, you're a virgin. You've slept with this person. But this person slept with this person, so technically you've slept with them too.
And yeah, exactly.
That dichotomy with that. We're
never saw that line drawing, but
it's
I should
me,
try.
Actually.
I should use it to scare the kids today.
Yes, you should, actually.
All right. So we talked a little bit about syphilis. We talked a little bit about chlamydia. The message I think there is that you don't see the symptoms, so you should get tested if you think there's been any exposure.
Right.
Is that
exactly.
about right?
Yeah.
The sex education side of it. And then gonorrhea. So gonorrhea, we have other words for gonorrhea, like the drip.
Yeah.
And what other words is there?
The clap.
What's with the clap? Why?
I don't know where that came from.
This is weird. I don't understand that. Anyway,
or
okay.
Dose, I think, was the term, too. I got a dose.
You got a dose, yes.
Yeah.
So the magazine Dose, that's very very popular one in Vancouver. I think that they have a sense of humor. I think that they actually got it from that. But anyway, so I can understand the drip because I know that men drip stuff out of the opening of their
yeah, they can
opening.
Out of the urethra. They can, but
gonorrhea
can be asymptomatic too.
Okay, sorry. The one-eyed snake. Sometimes people are like, urethra, what is that? So the hole at the end of your penis there. Yes, the one-eyed trouser snake.
Yeah.
So there's stuff dripping out of it, guys. If there's stuff dripping out, that's perhaps gonorrhea. And what color might it be, doctor?
Gonorrhea is more likely to be lots of discharge and kind of yellow.
Okay.
So and there can be a little bit of burning.
Burning with peeing?
Yeah, but the burning isn't a big feature. It's kind of more sometimes a little itching, maybe a little bit of burning with peeing or without.
Okay.
Just kind of irritation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sounds good.
Yeah.
What do women have as symptoms for gonorrhea?
They're kind of more subtle because women normally have a vaginal discharge, so it would be more discharge.
Than usual.
That's right. And if the
Any
gonorrhea...
Any smell or taste difference?
Not... Really? I've never heard anybody talk about the taste.
Well, because I notice with taste difference between for BV, for example, or what's the other one that's the parasite?
The Trichomonas.
Trich. So Trich is very stinky.
They definitely smell
It has a very bitter flavor. And you might want to ask how I know this, but I've got it off the internet.
Well, it must be true, right?
A friend got it one time. And then there's also the BV has a very bitterish kind of flavor as well.
It certainly has that kind of fishy odor.
And it has the smell. So ladies, if your bits are stinking... More than usual, there's something going on. Okay, so...
I do have a question, though, in terms of gonorrhea and chlamydia, herpes, syphilis, the whole nine yards. Can you get it in your throat or other places?
Well, gonorrhea and chlamydia you can get in your throat. They don't cause much in the way of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Things usually are more effectively passed penis to cavity than cavity to penis, so... usually, if you had gonorrhea or chlamydia in the throat, it would
be from a penis.
Yeah, yes. It would mean a penis had been back there.
back there. If you're a good deep throater, if you know what you're doing, perhaps you're going to get
right.
it. Okay.
Tests on the throat for chlamydia, I think it's not as significant as gonorrhea. So there doesn't seem to be much interest in researchers in testing for chlamydia in the throat. Gonorrhea definitely, because occasionally it can go in the bloodstream too.
Mm.
So chlamydia doesn't tend to do that. So,
interesting.
But the trick about syphilis, the interesting thing is syphilis, well, it isn't so much in the throat. It can be in the throat, but the primary stage of syphilis is where, again, we're talking about people with symptoms, but if they have a stage, they have symptoms, that's a sore mm-hmm. where it enters the body, and it could be the throat, it could be the lips. The sore can often be painless. And the other thing about syphilis is, so that sore is quite infectious. Then that sore can disappear after a few weeks, and then people can get the secondary rash. But along with that, there are tiny lesions often in the mouth. So syphilis is actually quite infectious from the blowjob standpoint, whereas HIV is of very low infectivity. So you can definitely catch syphilis from a blowjob, but it's harder to catch HIV that way.
Right.
So that's kind of a little wrinkle at syphilis. I heard somebody call it the stealth pathogen.
Oh, the stealth pathogen.
I love
that
phrase.
You talked about the stealth pathogen of syphilis by this example that you sent me on internet, email, about the piggybacking. Can you tell that story? That was very interesting.
Oh, that's right. This was kind of when I first started down here, I was in public health, and one of the docs I was with had a patient who had this primary syphilis sore on the back of his neck. And then I heard of another case like that, and their boyfriends had piggybacked the girls around their apartment without anything on, and I guess they must have had the primary sore on the lips of the vagina, so then the guys ended up with them on the backs of their neck. Not at the same time. This was at different times.
I think that's really shocking to me. I mean, it's just amazing that that thickness, because the skin on the back of your neck and on your back in general is the thickest skin on your body, isn't it, really, besides your feet?
Yeah.
You know?
And you can get it on the nipple, too.
And if you can get it on that thick part of your skin, that's a pretty infectious, well, have you ever seen the syphilis, listeners, if you've seen the syphilis organism, it's like a corkscrew. This thing is like a tough little mother. It comes right into it drills itself, obviously, right into your skin. So
it looks like it does, doesn't it?
It's kind of crazy.
It. Yeah, it's kind of like a tiny little spring that rotates slowly on its axis, and it undulates in the middle. It's a very regal organism, actually. Has
it's
a nice name,
nice looking.
Too. Treponema pallidum. Such a regal name.
Oh, very regal. Good thing it can get from vaginal lips right into your neck. And down your throat when you stick a penis in your throat. My God. We've got to start to respect this syphilis thing here, everyone.
No,
all right.
We've got to respect just sex in general.
Yes,
I think it's
true.
Interesting. Just, you know, we always want to protect ourselves, and
right.
condoms are really super awesome, but that's a perfect example of how condoms
don't protect
aren't everything.
Help you.
And
right.
you've got to really know your partner. A girlfriend of mine actually ended up with a whole rash of genital warts on her stomach, of
uh-huh.
all places,
uh-huh.
which I'd never heard of that before.
Uh-huh.
I just thought that was really interesting.
Hmm.
And I've even got a girlfriend who gets herpes outbreaks on her finger. So you must hear of a lot of different types of stories. Have you heard of other ones?
Yeah, certainly. And with with HIV, gonorrhea, and chlamydia, condoms are quite good because usually it's the fluid coming out of the end of the penis or out of the cervix has to get into the end of the penis. But the other things like syphilis, herpes, HPV are skin-to-skin contact, so the condom doesn't cover everything.
Right. Mm.
Female condom might cover a little bit more.
Yeah, female condom's good for some things like that, yeah.
They're
but
expensive.
You know what? Get that.
And
they
I hear they're
expensive.
Squeaky, too.
They make a lot of noise. They feel like you're having sex in a rubber, in a little bit of a plastic
like
bag.
A garbage
like
bag.
A grocery bag. You're having sex in a grocery bag. Hey, if you like that kind of thing, just turn the music up. Maybe you won't hear it. That's what I tell the kids in the classes. But, you know...
You can feel the difference.
Well, anyway, it could be interesting. I mean, if you like rubber gloves, they can be kinky too, so whatever, you just gotta kind of go with it.
Condoms.
I was thinking though that oh darn, I lost my thought.
Oh baby.
What I was gonna suggest to people is just get the light on and put it on the genitals of your potential lover. I mean, just flip the lights on, get the flashlight. I have a flashlight by the side of my bed, and people often ask me. And they say, you know, why do you have a flashlight? I'm thinking that maybe if the lights go out in the middle of the night and I need help. It's actually to shine on the genitals of my new lovers because I'm sorry. And I'm a sex educator, and I can say it's all in the name of research, just checking you out, da-da-da-da. And they kind of can understand that I'd be a bit paranoid in my line of work. You know, I've heard horror stories and seen many things. So yeah.
A new aspect of foreplay.
An aspect of foreplay.
Yeah.
I use the extra warm light so it feels warm on the genitals, and maybe they can cover their face so they don't get bright lights in their eyes. And if it's a female lover, get the duck bills. You know, I have my own cervical examiner thing.
Really?
Stick
it
right into their
too.
Vagina, crank the thing open, get the light in there. And they're grateful because I'm doing my own little exam there, and I tell them they look good. And then they're all like, what do you think? What does my cervix look like? Do you like it?
So I know if I ever get together with you, I'm going to be
duck
the patient.
Bills. Duck bills, honey.
Because
okay.
I have no idea what to look for. I think that's a great idea. But how do we educate our listeners in terms of how to look for things? I wouldn't have a clue what to look for, what things look like.
Maybe the good doctor can tell us when we get back from the break.
That'd be great. We will be right back, and we've got a special special song for a certain friend of ours out there.
A certain friend, excuse me, the song is called what, Caroline? What is the song called? Excuse me. The song is for a certain
laugh,
friend.
Julia.
How to Lose Everything, it says, and the band is called Hot Little Rocket. You know who we're telling you,
yes,
who this is
knows,
for.
And it's not so little.
Hot Little Rocket is not so little, and it's called Cough Me Out. This song is for you, Hot Little Rocket.
And we will be right back.
This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Lust and an alert. Who's lust and an alert? Jurisprudence isn't easy, so let's solve litigate and learn. action. Check it out.
Need your monthly fix of girls hitting each other on skates? Well, it's your lucky day. We practice once a month, and we want you to come and watch. You like to watch, don't you? The Terminal City Roller Girls Monthly Scrimmage, Sunday, December 2nd from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the UBC Osborne Center, 6108 Thunderbird Boulevard, Unit 2. Bring a warm jacket. Despite the hot roller derby action, it can get pretty cold in there. And don't forget, we want to have more places to hold events in Vancouver, so we're still saving up for that darn sport court floor. We'll pass the hat at intermission, so any kind donations would be much appreciated. The Terminal City Roller Girls Monthly Scrimmage, Sunday, December 2nd, 2007, at the UBC Osborne Center.
Juice Box is a sexuality education show geared to adult audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Yes, yes, and we are back. You are in Juice Box listening to, as you know, CITR in Vancouver. And you know what? We forgot to tell you to call in. So 822-2487 if you have any questions for the good doctor. We're listening to The Good, The Bad, and The Scary, chatting to Dr. Hugh Jones from the BC Centre for Disease Control, otherwise known as the STI clinic, the big one in Vancouver, where you can go get tested with even just a fake name and no MSP coverage. So I think that's a pretty good thing to know. I didn't know that until we had Dr. Jones on the show. So here we go. We're back. And what's going on? We have to do juice berries first before we do any more of this talking about sex thing. Right?
November 30th is definitely a popular date. We've got Get Ready for the Stage going on at the Penthouse. And so there'll be lots of sexy, naughty pole dancers pole dancing away and raising money for charity.
Fabulous.
With their clothes on.
Ah, right.
Sorry, I had to put that in there beforehand. Proceeds are going to Beauty Night Society. And you can get tickets through 604-731-8070. And that's through Radio Fitness. So that's going on. Plus, Malika's got her event on, and Julia's ordering me to hurry up. So I'm going to get spanked hard if I don't shut my mouth.
Okay, we already said the Wise Hall, November 30th. Malika Millions. Just check out her websites and things. I'm sure you'll find out the information. Because we don't have it in front of us. Sorry. It will be a good night, as always, things are with Malika.
So before the group, before
yes,
the, yeah, we were
before the break,
we were talking about what to look for, because as unlike Julia, I wish Julia, darling, I could do the what you do, where I could actually go there with a flashlight.
Just
but I'd have
video
no clue.
Cam
to me, it looks like a penis. So, and how do you go through all the pubic hair and all that stuff and find what you're looking for? Or do you just shave it?
I can't tell you the amount of times I've done this thing when I was younger and found crabs.
Really?
Right in their pubic hair.
Really?
Yeah. So I've saved myself from several things over the years, including probably another bout of herpes and what else? All right.
So what visual
yes, what visual? Help us out here. Help
we
the good
help.
Listeners.
Well, certainly, your thing about the crabs is a good one, though they aren't always that easy to see. You have to kind of move your finger around a little bit and see if they move a bit. You look for the lice and the nits, you know, the little things hanging onto the hair. Let's see that. The discharges we talked about,
yes.
You know, from the end of the penis. I mean, it's
clear, slippery stuff is good, girls and boys, because that's just lubricant. It's natural for the coming out of the male.
Yeah, if it's starting to get a little cloudy, like with gonorrhea, it's yellow. It can be not so yellow, though. And with chlamydia, it tends, we call it mucopurulent, so it's kind of a little clear and slippery with a little yellow mixed in. I mean, that shows you how tricky it is, you know, because clear and slippery could be normal. And in women, it's harder to tell because discharges in women vary. I mean, you can look for the sores, obviously, the syphilis sore.
On the
sore.
Outside, yes.
Yeah, syphilis sore can be about the size of a dime, and sometimes it has hardened edges. Herpes has the usually little cluster of, not necessarily ulcers, and a lot of the herpes we see isn't painful. People just come in, what is this? And it's a cluster of little ulcers or scabs or sometimes blisters, but some people don't notice the blisters that are kind of distributed like if you threw a handful of pebbles into a pond. There's this cluster of these little things.
Mm-hmm.
And then warts are little bumps that are kind of on top of the skin, though people tend to be a little bumpy down there anyway. So it's often difficult knowing unless there's something dramatically different. And 70% of people are infected with the genital HPV virus. Anyway.
Really? Whoa.
What was 70%?
70%.
70.
Now, some experts believe that most people clear the virus in about 8 months or so, and other experts think maybe nobody clears it. It just becomes undetectable by the tests. And treatment doesn't get rid of the virus. So if you missed noticing a warts, you can, if you leave them, they'll stay there, get bigger, or go away by themselves. Warts can be hypnotized away. I know a doctor with kids with hand warts sends them down the street to a witchy woman and has them cursed, and that makes them go away.
Right on. I'm all over that stuff. I believe in that wholeheartedly. And I'm glad to hear you say that, doctor, because honestly, most people in the medical profession don't go near that stuff. So I agree with it, though. I've healed many things with my mind, and I'll continue to do so.
Yeah. Mind is a very powerful tool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so you can look for those bumps, but don't look too hard, I would say. That's what I always tell
people. Okay, so this is going to, let's talk about the bumps here for a minute. My experience is that warts have kind of like, they don't have that smooth surface. They have kind of like a little bit of a bumpy surface, which makes warts a little easier to detect than just like your average kind of ingrown hair or a healing kind of ingrown hair scar or other kind of little bumps that can easily become part of your normal skin tone or skin, whatever, texture. That's one of the things that I kind of can see often in warts is that little bumpiness on top, cauliflower-ish sometimes. No?
Most of the warts that we see aren't
like that.
Bumpy and aren't cauliflower-ish. Those are, sometimes they can have little speckles of red dots on the surface. Mm-hmm. That's the little capillaries coming up. We call those capillary loops. And if you look with a magnifying glass, you can see them. But the thing about warts, they look like little plateaus on the skin. Mm. And so,
they have a kind of a flatter surface, as opposed, like they kind of come up like a crater.
Yeah, whereas, thing. You know, an ingrown hair crater, or something, though. It's kind of more like a little mountain, where these are more like little plateaus.
Right.
The other thing that can look a lot like that is molluscum.
Right.
And that,
I've detected that several times, too, and sent people to the...
There you go, eh? Yeah.
I have friends come, you wouldn't believe this, I have friends arrive at my doorstep with flashing me their genitals before I can even close the door and lock it.
Oh, there you go.
They're like, what is this thing on here? And they're like pulling their skirts up, and I'm like, okay, oh my God. Nice to see you. Would you like a cup of tea first before we get to your genitals? It's like, yeah. So I've seen a lot, and I have diagnosed things quite successfully over the years. Anyway.
Yeah.
But yes, the plateau thing is right. I agree. I think that's one distinction. And of course, smells and bubbles. Girls that have bubbles coming out of their vagina on a regular basis usually probably have trich.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? So bubbles are a very distinctive feeling. So if you have a bubble coming out of your vagina, you know, maybe one is okay.
Are we talking like a big
burst?
But
just little bubbles, little poppy,
kind of frothy.
Frothy kind of poppily bubbles, like you had maybe some ginger ale from your vagina. Little tiny
fizzy?
Bubbles. Little bubbles. I don't know.
And there usually is that fishy odor along
fishy
with
smell
it, too.
As well, quite
and
smell strong.
If the guy doesn't use a condom, the ejaculate is basic, and it causes the liberation of more fishy odor. So we actually, one of our examination things is we take some of the vaginal discharge and put potassium hydroxide on it and sniff it.
Is that what's in sperm?
And we sniff it. Yeah, well, I don't know if there's potassium hydroxide.
It's a sniff test.
It is. The sniff test. The whiff test, we call it.
The whiff test.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, I had no idea you guys got so into your work.
Yeah, we do the smear, we do... The smear, the typical discharge, the whiff test, and a pH.
Oh, my God.
There you go, eh?
Here I do. It's all just like, you got bubbles? Okay, good. Go to the doctor. Okay.
But so far, no taste test.
The taste test, that's just getting too close to your work. That's just way too close to
your
work.
Diabetes mellitus, the name came because one of the tests the doctor tasted the urine. And it means sweet. If the urine was sweet, that was a test for diabetes way back when.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I have two diabetic siblings, so I'm sure they'd be happy, and a diabetic niece, so I'm sure they'd be happy to hear about that.
Wow. Going back to the warts.
Back to the warts. Okay.
Does that usually tie in sometime with the HPV virus always, or not necessarily?
Always with the HPV virus.
Okay.
And it's the skin-to-skin thing. So the thing, best way to protect yourself, condoms reduce transmission, but the immunization for girls before they become sexually active, and probably for men too.
Mm-hmm.
It's the two commonest cancer-causing types of HPV and the two commonest wart-causing. The types of warts...
Oh, is it really? I thought it was just for the cancer-causing one.
No, it's just the other two bumps, too. The types of HPV that tend to cause cancer don't tend to cause warts.
Right, yes, I knew that.
The other type, now there's another vaccine coming out that may just do the cancer-causing. But the one right now...
I didn't know that.
The Gardasil is for two cancer-causing and two bump-causing.
Wow.
And it... probably be good for men to get immunized too, and it probably will reduce head and neck cancers as well.
Wow. Holy cow. Whoa. Okay, this is interesting information. I want to know, Caroline has a question too, but how much does it cost for these vaccines?
I think it's something like $300 or something like that. But in
a lot of money. It's an oppressive amount of money.
I think next fall, the provincial government's actually going to have an immunization program for young girls before they're
sexually
active.
See, young girls, right? Like, that's totally unfair and uncool because I would like to get vaccinated and I can't afford it.
Yeah.
I don't have HPV. I'm one of the rare 30% of people who don't.
Right.
So why is it before the age of 26, is it, that they're able to get vaccinated? But after that, is it because they think...
I think probably by that time you got it, whether you have symptoms or not. I think most people with HPV don't have symptoms. So just because you don't have bumps doesn't mean that you don't have it. And that's why you have the pap smears, too.
Right. You get your blood work done, you can find out.
So how do you see all this and not get paranoid? Because I know myself, you know me, Julia, when we've done shows on things, I start believing I have everything.
Yeah, you're a bit of a hypochondriac.
I am. So, and I'm sure there's other people out there like me where...
Yes, well, nobody wants...
No, how do you...
Nobody wants to get things.
Kind of gauge in terms of... basically educating people but not making them so it's like mass hysteria, I guess.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, certainly if you and your partner get tested, that doesn't kind of help for the HPV or even for the herpes at this point. But for the other things, gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, HIV. Did I miss something? Gonorrhea, syphilis, chlamydia, HIV. I think that's the main ones we do. And then the vaginal ones for women, the yeast and the bacterial vaginosis and the trich. Those kind of things.
Well, the trich, the bacterial vaginosis and the yeast don't really harm you long term. So it's not as much of an urgent thing. It's
right.
The BV and yeast are already naturally occurring. It's just an overgrowth, so it's not really an issue at all. It's just the smell or whatever. I don't know how tricked has any kind of long-term effect at all, but...
I think it can... some people think it can affect prematurity or premature rupture of the membranes and things like that.
Mm. Okay.
So I think it can have that effect. And, of course, the BV can, especially if you have... procedure like an insertion of an IUD or a therapeutic abortion, it can do the PID or the pelvic infection thing.
Yes, exactly. Right. Okay, if we're going to have something invasive happening. But good to clear it up anyway. That's true.
Yeah, that's right.
And, of course, the yeast is very uncomfortable, as we know, us women.
Yes.
All right. So there's a couple of things. We want to ask a little bit about herpes. What do we want to ask about herpes?
Well, Julia had a theory that we've mentioned before, just in terms of just that it can be spread without symptoms. And we're wondering, is that mainly spread through just some of the...
Penis, vagina, rectal. There's an oral genital exchange that can happen from herpes 1 and herpes 2. We've talked about this a lot. We do have podcasts about herpes that are, you can go back into the history. I guess what I wanted to ask you is your opinion on this sort of hysteria thing that's happening around, like you can get it at any time, any place. And I know for a fact that some of the research does lean towards that, but the majority of research is saying that, you know, a lot of people have herpes and are totally... get the prodromes, the signs that they're going to be getting an outbreak of some kind, well before they get any kind of sore that's going to be, or any kind of shedding happens in the virus where it becomes transmittable, that kind of thing. So what are your thoughts on that? Because I've been seeing all these posters, like you can get it anytime, anywhere, you know, you're never safe, and all this kind of hysteria going on around herpes, and just wanted to think what you thought about that, because I know in the medical world it seems... that there's a lot of belief that, you know, it's impossible not to get it, pretty much.
Well, it's a complicated business. More people in North America find out they have herpes because they give it to somebody than find out because they have symptoms. And I think it's estimated just across the board that maybe 1 in 5 people who are sexually active have the type 2 herpes.
And that's genital herpes, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it varies with populations. Most of the spread, I think, that we see is kind of penis-vagina sort of thing, or, you know, penis-rectum. But there is oral spread, too. Mm-hmm, and the oral spread, a lot of people have type 1. Most oral herpes is type 1. Most genital herpes is type 2. But some oral herpes is type 2 and some genital type 1. And so the spread, if it's oral sex, probably the person would catch type 1 genitally, especially if they've never had oral herpes. Like about 70% of people who've never had oral cold sores still have had type 1 herpes in their mouth.
Right.
So
yeah.
That probably protects you against catching it genitally, or at least against getting symptoms.
If you have type 1 in your mouth?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
And if you catch type 2 genitally, it could reduce, you know, the primary symptoms. But as time goes on, we see lots of people have asymptomatic primaries and then later on have recurrences. So
it's all kinds of mixtures, isn't it?
Yeah. So there are lots of people that catch it, get no symptoms at all, and maybe have sex with somebody else who has no symptoms at all. And then every once in a while, somebody gets symptoms.
Yeah.
So again, it's kind of the tip of the iceberg. So condoms reduce transmission. The vaccine that they were so hopeful about actually only works for women, doesn't work for men, and only works for women if they don't have type 1 orally. So it would only work for about 30% of women. I think they're still studying that.
I was going to say, I wondered what happened because I knew some people in that study and that were eligible for it and were in it with the vaccine, and I was very hopeful that it was coming out soon or something was going to be happening. So
I mean, it still works for 30%, so that's
better
something.
You know, and let's just talk briefly. Herpes is really just a skin condition thing that happens. I mean, how does it really harm you long term? People seem to be so afraid they confuse it with this, you know, HIV, or is going to be something shortening their life,
or syphilis.
Or something. So can you sort of speak to what there is for as far as risks? I mean, because so many people have it. Like, let's try to alleviate some people's fears and upset about their future health and whatever. Like, does it really affect your future health, like your longevity, your, like, you know...
Well, besides giving birth to a baby where you have to make sure you don't have it so you don't have a blind baby, but...
Right, that's right. Or, yeah, the babies can be severely infected, especially if a woman catches herpes in the last trimester. Then she's giving off a lot of virus and she hasn't passed antibodies to the baby. She hasn't made enough antibodies to pass to the baby. So that's the
highest.
That's
not a good time to be getting your primary infection.
No.
When you're pregnant, for 6 months pregnant or more. Okay, good to know. And then also vaginally delivering, if you have an outbreak, then they will do a C-section to protect the baby. So those are two pretty extreme things that could happen. Is there anything else, like longevity?
Not really, no. I mean, I think the toughest thing with herpes, with a lot of people with herpes, isn't so much the symptoms, it's worrying about giving it to somebody else feeling responsible about that. And
That can be hard on a person, for
sure. And that's probably there are some people that have painful recurrences. They may not be frequent or they may be frequent, but they're probably more the exceptions. And there are three different oral anti-herpes drugs that can be used for that don't cure it, but they can reduce the symptoms. The unluckiest people are the people that have to take them all the time, and that can cost about $90 a month. Might have to take them for a few years.
Yeah, I don't know. I have issues with the suppression of these things. Anyway, again, we have entire shows on herpes. So let's move on to giving people the bad news. Because we were going to ask, you know, paint us a picture of someone who might come in and what a physical entails and what to sort of expect there. And, you know, we've got about not even 10 minutes. So. Mm-hmm.
So how does it feel when you have to give somebody the bad news? Like, say they came in for an AIDS test. And actually, that was a question I wanted to ask before we get into that, which is, how long do you have to wait now to get your test results? Like, and how soon can you test? Like, basically, say you've had unprotected sex with somebody, and how soon do you have to wait before you?
When you in the clear? When are you in the clear? Yeah.
Well, the test that we use right now is an antibody test. So we look at what the person's blood makes to fight the infection, even though it's not terribly effective. And the antibodies that can be measured by our tests appear in about 4 to 6 weeks, can take up to 3 months. We used to say 6 months, but in North America, I think they still say 6 months, but in Europe, they go with 3 months. So I think probably 3 months is the time. Mm-hmm. So if you had a test 3 months after a contact that you're worried about and it was negative, I'd say that you're okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay, good. I've been saying that 3 months, you know, I mean, use condoms all the time until you both get tested 3 months into your relationship if you're monogamous and honest. And then you can go ahead and just use something that doesn't involve a barrier because you're good to go. So it's good to know because a lot of people think, you know, fine, I'll use condoms. I know that it's safe and it protects me. But most people don't want to use condoms. You know, they feel like it interferes with their energy exchange, obviously the level of sensitivity, et cetera. So often I'll say, you know what, just wait it out for 3 months if you can't, you know, with your partner using condoms, and then once you're tested, you're in the clear, and you can go ahead and use some other methods that don't involve barriers. So,
yeah, and you both need to be tested.
Yes, of course.
When 3 months, so it has to be 3 months for each person after the last time they're with somebody else and both tested. So,
thank you, doctor.
Don't count on your results reflecting the other person's results.
Right.
So, have you had to ever give somebody the bad news?
I have, and certainly I work with usually about 5 nurses at the same time. And when we do the testing, we try and be the person that gives the results if it is positive. And it's not a pleasant thing to do.
And
I mean, there is treatment
job.
And everything, but it is part of the job. And, you know, we try to give it as compassionately as possible, but it's rough news to give. You know, their life's going to change. They're probably going to need to be on medication at some time, and they need to consider the infectivity. And so it's a big kind of life-changing experience. So
that can be for something like HIV, HPV, or something that stays with you forever or affects your longevity. Other STIs, I think, is just sort of like, you know, here's your prescription, you'll be fine. Just make sure you tell the people that have, you know, if you have chlamydia,
that's
gonorrhea,
right,
or syphilis, you're pretty much the person just needs to take some pills. And
and how do you recommend that they tell people? Like, say they, like my brother's got a really good friend who's HIV positive, for example. And what would be the best way to actually tell somebody when you're getting involved with them?
I don't know. That's a tough one.
It's a personal process, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you certainly. I would want to be upfront pretty quick about it.
Because that one's a life or death. Well, it's actually a criminal thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Sex with somebody with...
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if I'm an expert on
it
either.
You could probably just slot it up with how do you communicate about anything to do with sort of sexual matters that are important. You know, you tread lightly, you have compassion, you use, you know, assertive communication styles, you know.
What does that mean in layman's
terms? Well, you don't have a lot of shame and sort of, you know, your body... communication with your body is sort of just like, this is the facts, this is what it is, this is what I know about it, this is where you can go for more information, this is how I know that we can protect ourselves, and delivering this information without the shame and embarrassment that is unnecessary to come with any STI. I think we all come upon them quite innocently. Often people give them to us innocently, not knowing they have them. And just to try to get some of the stigma out of these conversations, because honestly, everything but HIV is really a nuisance and or curable. So I think people need to sort of not be as shame-filled as they tend to feel. Yes?
And I was also going to ask about Hep C. I just wanted to just touch on that briefly, because we haven't mentioned that one in terms of an STI.
It's not... it's not terribly effectively spread sexually. But there seems to be some question about whether in gay men who are HIV positive, they tend to be more likely to be positive for Hep C. So there is some transmission, but it's not one that's very effectively transmitted. I think there were some guidelines put out by a family practice group, and something to do with the federal government, too, recommending that anybody that was sexually active should have a Hep C test.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That seems a bit over the top. When I asked Dr. Cragden, who's the virologist, about that, he said, well, if that's what they recommend, then it certainly could be done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not as, I think, as important as having HIV testing and and syphilis testing and things like that. And certainly you wouldn't want to have them too frequently. Though we do have some adults, entertainment workers, who I think have the test every month.
They have HIV or whatever. They just get the full...
Yeah, they get the full battery
testing,
of
yeah.
tests monthly. Sometimes I think it's required by the employer to...
Oh, really? Well, you know what? I think that makes sense. I mean, if you're having sex with multiple partners all the time and it's part of your job, then that makes good sense that you'd get tested monthly.
Right.
You know, we got to protect each other from these kind of things. Again, a lot of asymptomatic issues out there, right?
Exactly.
So
that's
often we don't have a clue, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, our sex trade worker who sees us, you know, all of a sudden gets it. They're like, well, I got it from one of my Johns or whatever. And I'm going to go back and tell them all that they, so one of them has it. So it's a good measure to protect it from being spread around. Mm-hmm. Now, on the condom conversation, just to quickly say, the Germans are trying to create a spray-on condom. So because a lot of these penises that are, they feel that they're too small or too large to fit a condom properly. So the Germans, bless them, are coming up with a spray-on condom soon to be injected out of some, it's a system that works a bit like a car wash. He puts his penis into a chamber and presses a button, starts a jet of liquid latex sucked from a detachable cartridge, and the rubber dries in seconds, which is then later rolled off and discarded like a conventional condom.
Wow.
These little kits might be a little large to stick your cock into, but hey.
We were very curious in terms of that. Julie and I were laughing about this earlier because there's no space for any
semen.
There's
no,
come out.
Where's the bag? How are they going to, the ejaculate comes out at quite a velocity and could easily break through this thing, but who knows? It also looks a bit thick, the stuff, but
it could be a new fetish. Get yourself latex. Oh, baby, please, do you have a latex machine? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, please, baby.
You gotta be, gotta impress these Germans. They impress me, these Germans. But it was a Dr. Jan Vincent Kraus, director of the Institute for Condom Consultancy.
Condom Consultancy.
Condom Consultancy. So, anyway, just had that little juicy bit there. I had to throw in at the end. All right, so...
Dr. Jones, thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay, thanks for
we
asking me.
We definitely have to have you back on again.
We would love to have you back. We can even maybe call you a juice box boy someday.
Oh, there you go.
That would be fabulous.
That sounds great.
We don't have one. So, you know, Caroline and I like men, so we'd have to, we
like
need to find
a
man, don't we, darling?
Men is good.
Men is good. Man is good. All right. So, all right. We hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and thanks so much, and we'd love to have you back. So,
okay.
Caroline and I are going to be back next week, aren't we, darling?
We are at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock.
Right on. And next coming up is Hans Claus's Misery Hour with the sexy, sexy-licious Marion, who has just arrived in the house.
And I just wish you could see what he was wearing.
Oh,
he
what's he wearing
today? Hottest clothing.
Oh, he's
Look
got these fancy jeans with the... Oh, they're so
all
cool. Very Burning
bottom.
Man. Very Burning Man, his pants.
I don't
pants.
Know. I think they're very more Euro.
They're very cool, very cool. He's got little sparkly
and
bits and painted things.
Put his hand on his hip.
And
he's posing for us.
And we can you tell that Caroline and I really like Marion of Hans Claus of Misery? Now, honey, I think it's your job to do the engineering there.
I think so, too. So I suppose I should say goodnight.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much.
You just experienced Juicebox Radio, a show dedicated to developing your relational and individual sexual health, expressing diversity, celebrating queerness, and encouraging pleasure at all stages. Be sure to tune into Juicebox every Wednesday night at 10. In the meantime, you can check out juiceboxradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You're gonna have to give it to me.